The most famous one was Matthew Lyon. That was in 1798. He was a congressman from Vermont. He read a bunch of letters talking trash about John Adams when he was president. He called him unbound thirst for ridiculous pomp and selfish avarice. He basically was just like making fun of the president. And that's where the Sedition Act became controversial, because they essentially just used it to anybody who was making fun of the federal government or the Federalists.
All right, welcome back to The Buck Starts Here, a podcast that digs deep under the surface, examining the policies, people, and wild events that shape presidencies of the United States. I'm Kyle, your casual history connoisseur. My co-host is Eric Mason, a brilliant loose cannon economist who brings a wealth of knowledge and the wildest of all the historical facts to the table. We are in the middle of our Adams series. Just finished wrapping up the background, learning about how he defended some peoples and the Boston Massacre, the peaceful transition of power we talked about, and kind of hinted at some of the stuff we're going to talk about today with the Alien Sedition Acts. Eric, what other policies are you looking at maybe covering today?
Well, I think we should do Alien Sedition Act, absolutely. Talk a little bit about him drafting the Massachusetts Constitution, which became the basis of the U.S. Constitution. He also helped draft the Declaration of Independence with Jefferson, but I feel everybody probably already knows that story. I feel like we're
right.
He was heavily involved in the Treaty of Paris that ended the Revolutionary War.
I'm
kind of rapid firing through stuff we kind of covered during Washington that people already know. Right. The best ones are going to be the Alien Sedition Act. I really do think that's interesting, but I think in this episode and the episode afterwards, the quasi-war with the French. There's huge economic implications of that. It's kind of the first time the U.S. went to war with somebody who's not British. Mm-hmm. The XYZ affair, which was an insane story in America at the time. The founding of the Navy. Kyle, we got to do the founding of the Navy,
yes,
buddy.
Yes, we have to.
And the midnight appointments.
What?
The midnight appointments.
See, I'm not familiar with this one.
Grown up in Quincy, and particularly also grown up in Massachusetts, we learn like really, really, really detailed American Revolution, because you can go like walk over there and be like, this is where it happened.
Right.
This is where it happened. the midnight appointments are currently going on right now as we're recording this on we're in late November right now. The Biden administration is doing midnight appointments too. Every president does it. That was not a political statement. That's every president does that, which is at that point in the political calendar.
Mm-hmm.
And then shortly before we go into the end of his presidency in the election of 1800, I think it'd be cool to talk about the Convention of 1800, which was this treaty between the U.S. and France that kind of set the U.S. on the course it stayed until World War II.
Mm. XYZ Affair, Convention of 1800s, I think is next episode. So this episode, I think, will be Alien Sedition Acts, and then any of the other ones that weren't those two, I think. I think I'd plan the next episode for those two.
Awesome. We can do like a whole episode on aliens. Like, we could do like five episodes. We can do one on honestly each of them. It's so interesting.
Well, where do you want to start? Start from the beginning. What was the first thing he did as president then that was of note?
Well, you know, the first thing he did would be he was the first person to, because he was the vice president at the time, confirm his election to president. The election of 1796, when John Adams was elected, was the last, for all practical sense, was the last election that the presidential election the U.S. ever had where there weren't running mates. So he goes into that election. He doesn't get to pick who he's going to be his number two, doesn't get to be able to pick.
Yeah, up to this point, his number two was just the other candidate, right? Whoever lost the election to him was now the vice president.
Yeah, I mean, it was whoever came in second place, because at the time we were running like coalition style.
Was nobody worried about the ramifications of that? I mean, if your side lost and you really wanted him to be in, like, there's only one guy standing in the way now.
No, right? Because we weren't that good at democracy yet. We didn't really know what to do. No, the number two guy will be the number two guy. It's like, no, right. That doesn't make a whole lot of sense because people tend to be very binary in how they do politics.
Right.
No, this will be fine. This will be fine. It's not like you can get two dudes who hate each other.
Right.
You get Jefferson and Adams. Immediately two guys who hate each other. So it wasn't until the adoption of the 12th Amendment in 1803 that you had running mates. But the election of 1800, which featured that was like the first proto running mate. You had Jefferson and Burr running essentially together. And then you had Pinckney and Adams running together. But yeah, so the first thing he did of his presidency was the last thing he did of his vice presidency, which is confirming himself being president. Into an immediate crap show. So inflation's running high during this time period. They're having the coinage crisis.
Is inflation because of the assumption of all the state debts? I think he carried on that, right? Washington implemented?
Yeah, so a lot of the stuff with Adams is just a carrying on of the economic policies of Washington. So, I mean, that's kind of cool because that level of continuity, you basically had 12 years of very stable, reliable policy decision-making for the economic side, which bolsters trade. Now, Adams being from the Northeast, being from a very trade-heavy area, there was kind of this thought that he would be more aggressive in reconciling with the Brits, reconciling with France, and kind of bringing back the status quo of trade. But it's important to remember, Adams wasn't a trader. He wasn't John Hancock. All right, he didn't run a company. He had a farm. His wife made them wealthy by investing in different assets. He wasn't a guy who really had a lot of financial interest in that type of trade.
Right.
And you know, that was good for the country because we are already starting to see some of the festering of different economic situations that would eventually lead to the Civil War at this time, where the southern colonies exported, you know, relying on slave labor and exporting cotton and indigo and rice and tobacco, were nervous that somebody up north who's more in this pre-industrial revolution, kind of not. I mean, you're already seeing strong textile demand and those type of machines in England. And at this point, we're starting to steal some of the technology back to the U.S. there was a very famous inventor who... he wanted to export a textile mill back to Massachusetts, and they wouldn't let him from England. And so he just memorized it. He went down there every day and memorized it, came back, and built one in Lowell, Massachusetts, which is now the birthplace of the American Industrial Revolution. And I think that's just some dude.
That's like hilarious.
pirating a textile machine design. But we're still dealing with a lot of inflation. The First National Bank still, you know, Kyle, just like you mentioned, it's absorbing the debt. It's structuring itself, trying to get an idea of what it means to be a national bank. Because don't forget, at this point, there were kind of national banks, but really the treasury was the king's treasury. With this idea of allowing, you know, if we take England, for example, allowing banks to issue pound sterling. Not the same as a national bank in a democratic society. You know, we were still recovering through the pains of the Articles of Confederation, from states being more important than the federal government and not issuing their own currency, but kind of issuing their own currency. And
They definitely were.
Yeah, they definitely were. Like, they say they weren't. They didn't want to admit it, but they were.
Yeah.
So Adams inherits this. You know, we're still recovering from some of the recession of 1794 to 1796. He comes in. In 1797, in March, is when he gets his inauguration goes off. So, I mean, the U.S. economy's not up and running again. But you start seeing the seeds of the Industrial Revolution come on. You're starting to see, really the economy starting to pick up. And, of course, right when this happens, the quasi-war with the French breaks out.
I don't remember what actually led to this. I thought this was more of an issue with, the Native Americans.
So that was the French and Indian War, where the French would just give a bunch of money to to the French, to the Native Americans. They were like, yo, go bother those dudes.
Right.
Yeah, because no, the U.S. would never do that, right? They would never take a group of people. There were four main causes from the historian's point. The first is the Jay Treaty, which we covered in the Washington episode.
Yeah.
I hate that that gets crapped on by people. It's like, oh, that's a bad treaty. Literally accomplished everything with no leverage.
But how would that lead to an issue with France? Other than maybe we just weren't giving them, we weren't trading with them as much as we were.
Yeah, so the France and Britain are always at war, even when they're not at war. So the French saw that as, instead of us normalizing relations with the Brits, as going against French interests.
Yeah.
And John Jay was like, no, what are you talking about? We're just trying to enforce like the Treaty of Paris. Like, we're not like pro-British now. We're just not actively fighting them. And the French were like, the neutral person of my enemy is my enemy, essentially.
If you're not actively fighting the British, then you're friends with the British.
Yeah, no, that was their view. So it royally ticked them off. So they interpreted the Jay Treaty as like this. I think what they wanted was America to leave the Jay Treaty never to occur, to force the Brits to still have to keep troops stationed on those forts that they weren't supposed to be in under the Treaty of Paris, and that would take troops away from this ongoing war that the French and the Brits were fighting.
But were they actually their own troops, or were they? I thought they just hired a bunch of Native Americans to come down there and fill them.
So the Brits had some of their own troops.
They did, then, okay.
Depending on which tribes were friendly. I mean, I shouldn't be so cavalier with this. I mean, different tribes had different relations with different European powers. Generally, the tribes that attacked on the American frontier had close relations with the French because of the long history of trading, and the Brits were much more heavy-handed in the conquering of Canada and the U.S. But you're right, Kyle. It's... Both statements are true. So the Brits were very upset with the Jay Treaty because they viewed that as like out freeing up troops to come back over and, you know, mess with the French. So America also declared its neutrality from all European conflicts, and they did that to maintain trade relations with both the Brits and the French. And to be honest with you, like, pretty much everybody in Europe at this time. Now, France kind of turned around and said, hey, remember that whole American Revolution thing? We were pretty supportive of that. Man, like, hanging out with us and helping us with these Brits. And we were like, oh, are you Louis the 16th?
Yeah. Yeah. Where is Louis? We talked to Louis. Where is he at? Send him over. We'll knock that out.
So, and this is more under Washington. And they were like, no, this is a new phone. Who this? And they were like, yeah, exactly. Like, like, you're not the government of France, so we didn't make a treaty with you. If Louis the 16th was asking us for help, we would do it, but we didn't. And so they took this like American neutrality mixed with like us disregarding what they considered the French. We didn't consider them French at the time. Did for us during the Revolutionary War. They considered that as like
it is kind of. I mean, they helped us free ourselves from the yoke of British rule, and then we turn around and we start trading with them again. Like, yeah, I can see why that might be a little annoying.
In fairness, it was 20 years afterwards.
Right. I mean, yeah, this isn't... That's a good point, too. Like, we don't hold grudges like the French do, I guess.
Yeah. Oh, I was going to say something. you're right. And I think a lot of the world kind of saw it that way. I think a lot of the world agrees with you on that, Kyle. The thing is that the Americans were like, hey, we make a ton of money from trade. Both the only thing we could all agree on between the North, the Central, and the South is that we all, the Mid-Atlantic, I should say, all were making money for a trading, the men we were trading with. And we were still actively trading with the Brits. Mm-hmm. But the thing that really sent people over the line. So the first thing Adams does, he gets into office and he sees this thing pending. He's like, oh my God, like this is going to blow up. This is going to be horrible. And if this ends up being something we can't trade with the French, or the French are attacking us, like, you know, we're going to have a real hard time going forward. So he sends over some American diplomats. And this is 1797. Mm-hmm. This is like right when he gets in. He says, hey, go over to the French and figure this out. Like, just whatever we need to do. Everybody's happy. We're not going into a war and going to be, you know, perpetually fighting wars in Europe for the next 200 years.
Right.
He goes do this. So the U.S. delegation shows up and they're met by three French diplomats, three French agents. Now, the newspapers referred to them as X, Y, and Z officials. That's where the term XYZ affairs comes from.
Okay.
And basically, they demanded a huge bribe before they would sit down and talk to any American.
Oh. Ooh, that's not something Adams is going to play around with.
Yeah, yeah. Adams is like, get back here now. So they end up coming back. They end up coming back to the United States. It's this huge issue, huge press. And suddenly, next thing you know, this explodes. The whole U.S. is anti-French. The whole U.S. is you know, pushing people against, is saying, we need to go to war. This calls for war. The 1798 rolls around. So this the XYZ affair happens like mid-ish to end of 1797. They come back. They're like, what do you want to do? And John Adams is like, do you know what we'll do? Sign the U.S. Navy into law.
Yes. God damn right.
Which is crazy if you think about it, Kyle, Mr. Navy veteran.
No, that's fucking awesome. Like, hey, you don't want to normalize agreements with us, then fuck you. We're just going to start our own Navy.
Yeah, you get these hands. And now we have the most powerful anything in the military ever formed, the U.S. Navy, and we've just continuously decided this was going to be our thing. We're just going to destroy it. We're just going to have the best Navy. We're going to make it our Navy is also going to be the best Air Force.
Well, it makes sense. Most of our trade goes to Europe. You absolutely need something to protect those shipping lanes.
Yeah, I do love how, you know, Kyle, you probably noticed this as somebody spent many years in the service, that the U.S. Navy is very weird compared to most navies currently, but throughout human history.
How do you mean?
So most navies were like, hey, let's get all these dudes on a boat, and we're going to drive them somewhere. And we're going to make sure we move supplies to support them. And this is where, like, battleships and stuff come in. It's the same way we end up with dogfighting an aircraft. We're like, some of the Navy vessels were like, oh, dude, I get to defend my cargo because somebody's going to shoot at me. But it was this idea of supply lines, right? It was the idea, like, we bring the troops somewhere.
Yeah.
And we'll do blockades. Maybe we'll do a shore bombardment if the Army needs us to do it. But, like, nah, maybe not. The U.S. kind of formed its whole shtick backwards. So the U.S. had this irregular militias that was used a lot with the Continental Army. But then the U.S. is like, what if, because we have a bunch of sailors and we were a coastal country, right? We were at the time, like, which is every state was coastal.
Yep.
And we had great shipbuilders. We were the Brits were using to build ships. So we had the best lumber. And somebody's like, dude, when we make our ships wicked fast and we also make them like, we'll put cannons on them and we'll get a bunch of really angry dudes on the ships too. And they'll go on other ships and take them over. and then you look at the modern Navy. The modern Navy's like, hey, it's like, oh, Navy, what do you have? It's like, all right, we have ships. Right, I always say that fact. The U.S., the Chinese Navy is bigger than the American Navy. I'm like, in number of ships, it's a quarter in tonnage.
Yes.
And
yes.
I always throw this at people, and Kyle, you probably already know the answer to this because I think I asked you this before. During World War II, what was the most common ship? It made up
probably nine, like the PT crew, those little PT torpedo boats, probably.
Your brain's in the right way. So this boat was the most famous boat. It was the most popular boat in the Navy. It made up 99% of all ships in the Navy. The Higgins boat.
Really?
Yeah. So what would you rather? Huh. The USS Iowa. One USS Iowa. Or 1,000 Higgins boats. Which are you taking?
I mean. Man, see, that's the problem with the Navy these days is the asymmetric risks. You have the Gerald Ford as the new version of the super carriers that are out there now, and they dwarf everything. But when you only have to get lucky with one missile hit to take something like that out, you'd almost rather have the 1,000 ships now.
Yeah, I mean, the failures of the littoral class ships and stuff like that was definitely that's done, because you could have so many littoral class. I mean, that's true with the Chinese Navy. They're not a blue water fleet, they're a white water littoral
one. Right.
So the U.S. but the U.S. policy now is like, we're gonna have the biggest Navy. It's like, cool, we're also gonna have the second biggest Air Force on all those things. It's like, but I thought you were ship people. No, we also have planes. Like, okay. And we're going to have a bunch of Marines on top of there too. It's like, what? You're not a Navy anymore. You're just an independent.
No, it's basically another country. Yes.
Yeah. wait, it's like, real quick. It's like, yeah, guy in the back raising your hand. Yes. Wait, aren't they already soldiers on the ships? It's like, sailors, but yeah, I know what you're saying. So why do you need other sailors? No, those are called Marines. You can't call them sailors. They get angry at that. What? Wait, what's going on? But you already, can't you just have a part of the Navy that just does like, goes on the shore and fights people? Yeah, we have those. That's the SEALs.
That's the Marines.
Yeah, like, then we have the Marines. Okay, so you're just your own country. You're just your own whole unit of operation now. And then, like, the Navy also has nuclear weapons, and it's, like...
Yeah, it's part of the triad.
Yeah, and I'm like, you're just your own shit over there. Like, you're just your own thing. Like, why are you acting like you're a branch?
When I was in, one submarine would have been, if it was its own country, it'd be the fourth most powerful nuclear nation in the world.
Yeah. So, but that's the mindset. That was the mindset. They took $1 million in 1797. And this is also meant to fight piracy. It's also important to remember that during this that you had
the Barbary pirate Barbary incident, states. Right? Yeah.
Yes. I don't know why. I was going to say the Barbary states, and I was like, no, that's not the right word.
Barbary. It's close.
Give you such a good haircut.
I'm sorry. Damn it.
But yeah, so the U.S. didn't come out here and make like privateer ships, which are some of the ships that like were kind of fighting them in the Quasi-War.
Yeah, a lot of it was letter marquee, right? Where if you owned a vessel, you can go to a government and say, hey, I'll be a privateer. You let me go legally attack these ships that you're at war with.
Yeah, and my favorite part about this is that, you know, everybody's making like these different types of frigates, and there was this whole concept of like, you know, you have your big man of war ships, and the Spanish were kind of good at that, but you know, they're an aging empire, so people right. Like, no, it's all about like, you know, being able to protect trade and all that. And everybody looks over to the U.S., and Mr. Adams is sitting there, and he's like, what type of ships do you want, Mr. Adams? And he commissioned right off the bat two ships, USS Constellation and Old Ironside, the USS Constitution. You can still visit that today.
Yes, I think I have a pen from there, actually.
Yeah. Oh, dude, that's sick.
They actually, it was from the gift shop. They took some of the wood that they replaced during the refits and made some pens out of them.
Oh, that's awesome. The U.S. Navy actually maintains a forest, I believe it's in Indiana, of the wood needed to rebuild the USS Constitution.
Oh, no shit.
Yeah, because it's still still active ship. Right. So, if anybody's ever been on the USS Constitution, I know your first thought's like, oh, that doesn't seem that big. That thing was a unit at the time. Like, you went from this country that had no navy to these guys, upper income country at the time. I guess modern, we'd call it upper income country. And they're just like, we're going to spend a lot of money on making two, and it's that same attitude that you brought up, Kyle, massive ships. Like, these things are going to be able to brawl out with the best of them. There's a bunch of other ships that were made, but the two big ones for the Quasi-War, a lot of the ships that the U.S. Navy commissioned weren't going to be completed until after the end of the Quasi-War. Right. And we'll talk about that during Jefferson, because there's some really cool stuff Jefferson did with the U.S. Navy. So Jefferson actually ran it when he ran against Adams, and Adams lost. Jefferson was like upset because Adams was still paying tribute to the Barbary states, and Adams ran on this thing, basically millions in defense, not a penny in tribute. I don't want to sound like an Adams apologist, but like, if there's anybody who's going to be an Adams apologist, it's me. We were fighting war with the French up until the convention of 1800. So I think if we were to open a second front in a Navy war.
We don't have a Navy yet either. Let's remember that too.
So this is one of the goals Kyle and I know talk a lot about is like, we're not here to give you the entire story. We don't have, nobody has time. You'd have to listen to us for days on days on end. But we want to, hopefully, you know, if there's little stuff we talk about as we go along, that'll make you more curious.
Yeah.
Especially of this obscure American history. Some of the most interesting American history is reading the different journals and after action reports of the U.S. Constitution, USS Constitution and USS Constellation as they just went down. Well, USS Constitution stayed more on like the Atlantic side and brawled with the French, but they went down to the Caribbean, the USS Constellation, and just messed everybody up. Just like, I want to make it very clear, these were not fair fights. USS Constitution were not built to ever be in a fair fight with another ship. They were built to roll up on you and cripple whatever you were doing and dip out.
44 gun frigates. Oh my god, that is huge. Yeah, that's like, man, that's ship of the line, like bigger than most of the British class.
And you gotta understand, this is a Quasi-War. You're not fighting the French Navy. You're fighting like privateers. You're fighting Joe with two cannons.
Right, this little like, sloop.
Yeah, there was no hold bars. Right. So the French never actually like, we did sink a lot of French ships. We encountered a lot of them. We did a lot of stuff that way. But they never, like, mounted, like, an armada to come over here. The French never really did that in general, but they were also nervous about the Brits.
They couldn't. They were in the middle of, weren't they in the middle of, like, the fight with the Brits? The Brits had all their shit, like, already blockaded at this point. Was this before the Battle of Trafalgar?
It would have been actually contemporary. Kyle, yeah. Yo, you're right on, buddy. So this was, exactly what you said. So it's they couldn't, they had some assets in the Caribbean, so they had some assets in North America, but nothing that could form an armada, and nothing that's going to take on, like, the most overpowered ships you should cruising around.
And these things were fast, too, man. Like, 13 knots is nothing to sneeze at for a ship of that size.
Yep, and that's, like, blistering fast for that time period. These things were... I don't want to call them the Ford-class carriers of the era, but they're not too far off of just...
Iowa class, I'd call it.
Yeah, Iowa class. When they rolled
it's
up
like
somewhere...
like the Bismarck.
When they rolled up somewhere, they were the boss dog. What's important to remember, too, is that these were built... I'm sure there's somebody sitting, somebody rolling over in their grave, some American shipbuilder, but these were built to British standards. We had all the British technology. We had all the British information on how to do this stuff. And that was actually,
it's kind of a big deal.
Huge to the U.S. economy because we inherited all the stuff we knew from the Brits. We had a huge leg up as a new starting nation. And all the people who were, all the governors, all the, the intelligent class, the artisan class, were still in the U.S. So, like, we inherited all that. We still had all that information. It's not like when you have, normally when you have civil wars or revolutions, the trained, the skilled class leave. So then your country kind of is destined to falter for a couple generations.
Right.
We had all this information, and we knew how to build ships. And we had the best lumber in the world to build the ships. And we did not underperform.
We were already doing it for the Brits.
Yeah.
Like, all that stuff didn't go away. They didn't come and destroy all those ship mills.
I
assume, right?
Oh, no. You're 100%. We also, and Kyle, I know you'll like this one. The U.S. Navy had adopted the British Navy training routine and sold Americans who were former British naval officers.
Mm.
So we kind of had like that skip a few rounds of figuring out how to run a Navy.
Right. Do you know that little, actually, it's a fun little fact too. The Navy uniforms, the dress blues that you see there. You know how they got that little flap on the back?
Yeah.
It looks like a cape. You know what that's for?
There's a hood that you guys, like, I don't know, like, wrap out a lot.
Oh, back in the, when the Navy was formed and those uniforms were designed, that was to keep their greasy hair from getting their uniforms dirty. Right?
Seems like washing your hair would be the solution to that, not making a flap.
There wasn't, I mean, you've been on the Constitution. Where are you going to wash your hair at?
Dude, I almost gave myself a concussion walking through there.
That's why I always wear a hat. That bill gives you one extra. It gives you 3 inches of warning before you bash your head into overhead pipes.
Last time I went to the USS Constitution, Tiff and I were with one of our friends, and she's British. And so you need an ID to get on it. And so she gave them the British passport. And the guy just looks at it and goes, I don't know if I should let you on this. And then he immediately apologized because he was like, I'm a security. I'm like,
joking.
Like he was a petty officer. He's like, I should be making jokes like that. And I was like, no, that's absolutely hilarious.
That's actually a good point. Yeah, there are actual enlisted people still serving on that boat.
Yeah, and it's like, you should make a joke about like national security. But I was like, dude, that was a good joke. That's another weird thing in history class. I've heard people say, like, they thought the USS Constitution was built to fight the British. And, like, the British would have been pumped when they heard about the USS Constitution being built.
Yeah, see, I thought the same thing. I mean, I know it was used against the British in, like, the War of 1812, right? But, I didn't realize it was built for this French incident. And going back to the XYZ affair here, Thomas Jefferson, I remember we're hearing, he was, like, a super big French apologist, super big fan of the French.
Yes.
And we know that he was very much anti-Adams, or at least it didn't seem like he was doing a whole lot to help him out. Was he kind of sabotaging things on relations-wise?
It's an interesting part in history. It's 1797, in the aftermath of the XYZ affair. It would have been a political poison pill if Jefferson came out against anything to do with there. Mm-hmm. He was. I would also agree with you, Kyle. Yeah, I think I would describe Jefferson as a French apologist in a lot of cases. I don't know if he was. I don't think he. From my research on this, I don't think Jefferson was actively.
He wasn't telling the officials, like, hey, demand a huge bribe just to piss these guys off.
I think Jefferson would have preferred them to settle it via treaty, because I think Jefferson really wanted to go mess up the Barbary States. He hated the Barbary States, because the important thing about Jefferson's life is that he was the one who went to Morocco and negotiated the first anything from an international treaty standpoint. Mm. With any other country, like the U.S. and Morocco. Morocco was the first country to acknowledge the U.S. as a nation. They have like our oldest peace treaty. He went there and he was like, hey, can you not attack our ships? And Morocco was like, okay, They weren't even like jerks about it.
Were they attacking us before? Or was it just go pick a country that was going to recognize us?
No, it kind of
Hey, French
was,
Ghana, you want to leave us alone, please?
More or less what happened is that I think they're called Sultans, the boss dog of Morocco, basically asked like, oh, since the Brits aren't paying your tribute, can you pay it for art? You need to pay the tribute? And like, it wasn't that controversial. I think you gotta look at it from Morocco's standpoint, like this military just defeated the biggest military in the world.
Yeah.
Like, do you really want to throw hands with somebody who still has that? Like, nah. You're like,
yeah, right.
The other Barbary states, they were pretty much all controlled by the Ottoman Empire at that time, so they were different. If anybody ever wants like an actually very good historical rundown, that's hilarious. I don't know if you've heard about there's a YouTube channel called The Fat Electrician. Give it a if anybody wants.
Sounds
to.
Sounds awesome.
Oh, he's very, very funny, very historically accurate. Now, I don't know if he's a big fan of Adams. There's a little shade of Adams during his one, but he gives it actually great breakdown of Stephen Decatur and what happened with the Barbary States under Jefferson. So highly recommend if somebody has like 20 minutes to watch it, Kyle. Like, you would find it absolutely hilarious because he breaks it down really good.
I'll link that in the episode description for this.
He does all his episodes are him just wearing a tank top.
And just nice. Like,
yeah, he was a medic in the army, and then he was like, "I'm going to start a YouTube channel." It's the funniest thing in the world because he's very, very smart, but also is like a dude from Iowa, so it's a good combination.
Awesome.
By the way, slightly off topic, but meeting when I went to a Big 12 school, so we played Iowa State, and I got to meet a lot of people from Iowa. I think Iowa is one of the best states in America, and people sleep on it, and I think Iowans do that on purpose so nobody goes there, and they don't turn into like Austin.
Yeah, I think they probably hate getting all of that attention during like the presidential cycles, because they're always the first one, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I just, so anybody here from Iowa, just know that you're a huge fan of Iowa. But this leads into what I think is a much more fun discussion, interesting discussion. So, quasi-war is going on. We build a navy. People want to go mess up the French and their supporters, which they do very handedly. Like, just the U.S. Navy shows up and just beats the crap out of anybody who's trying to challenge them. There isn't this big, like, there's no large-scale, like, military confrontation, but it's us just, like, kicking people in, kicking
one
in doors.
One ship at a time.
Yeah, like, we're just blowing up all this stuff. Like, there was no balance here. I don't want to think there's some great story of, like, valor against equal odds. No. It was a bunch of people who were raiding American ships, trying to take prisoners, U.S. sailors, trying to take them over, and the U.S. military showed up with 44 guns and some of the fastest ships and just started sinking anybody who wanted to mess with us. After about, I don't know, like, 2 weeks of this going around, people were like, wow, we need to stop doing this. Don't really have any, like, that's basically the quasi-war from a military standpoint. But what happens is, suddenly, after all this talks of the Articles of Confederation, Confederacy, state rights, all that jazz, what happens domestically? Well, domestically, everybody's like, we need a federal government. People become really animated towards federal governments. And so you end up with the forming of the first two-party system in the United States. You end up with the Federalists, which George Washington joins in the second term. John Adams is a Federalist. It's exactly what they say. They believe in the power of the federal government, and they believe the federal government as kind of a supreme decider, because they believe in the supremacy clause of the USS Constitution. The U.S. Constitution. Sorry, still thinking about
not
boats.
The USS Constitution.
And that's led by, you got our boys John Adams, you get Alexander Hamilton. Those are like your big Federalist. John Jay is a Federalist. But the second political party is not anti-federalist. There was an anti-federalist movement. It wasn't that popular. It was good for a little while. It kind of gave us the Bill of Rights, kind of didn't. You probably learned in school, if you've heard the term anti-federalist, most people are like, oh, that came from the Bill of Rights. And it did or didn't. It's not really, I don't know. It doesn't have a lot to do with John Adams. Somebody wants to yell at me that, oh, no, it was the anti-federalist that gave us the Bill of Rights, whatever. Yeah, sure. Not dying on that hill. There's many hills I'll die on, as Kyle knows, but not this.
That's not it.
So the second political party forms under Thomas Jefferson. It's the Democratic Republicans. They're led by Thomas Jefferson and James Madison. And there's this like weird thing that gets taught because we're so used to looking at like polarized political parties that like the Democratic Republicans were anti-federalist or the opposite political leanings of federalists. They weren't. They just thought the federalist style was too extreme because the federalist style started bordering kind of on like centralized government like you see in France today, as opposed to what we have in a modern federal system. But they were not anti-national government. And to be honest, they weren't anti-federal government. They were just like, yo, can you guys like not be as extreme and think like states basically should have no autonomy?
Yeah. So they'll let the states handle most of it. And then the government can handle the things that need to be unified.
Yes. And that leads us to the most interesting thing to happen under Mr. Adams' administration. Besides the founding of the U.S. Navy. I really want to say, I think the founding of the U.S. Navy is the number one thing he did.
That really is. I mean, that really put us on the path to becoming a world power that we are today.
Yes. And it's like the U.S. Navy provides, is why we have all free, we have free navigation of the oceans. It's something like food costs in undeveloped worlds would be like 50% higher if it wasn't for the U.S. Navy for providing free transport to the transportation of the seas.
Dude, our submarine could generate up to 8 megawatts of power. That's a submarine.
Insane. That is insane.
And there's been instances where they've hooked up vessels from the Navy, like in places that have been hit by hurricanes, to provide temporary power to those areas. There's some crazy cool things that the Navy can do.
Yeah, the Navy, like, there's something like 140 million more people would be exposed to food insecurity if it wasn't for the Navy allowing the transportation of food. Like, when I was growing up, there was always that commercial. It would be like, the U.S. Navy, a global force for good, is the most accurate statement. Like, I will die on this hill. That's a hill I'll die on. I'll die on a hill that the U.S. Navy is probably the single most powerful organization on earth, and second is actually just doing good things. Like we're the only Navy in the world that like that like won and then was like, you know what, free trade, everybody do your stuff, just free trade. But also, if you mess with us, we got some submarines that would like to have a conversation with you.
It'll be short, don't
be
worry,
very short. So the Alien and Sedition Act.
Yes.
Kyle loves this topic. Kyle, where do you want to begin?
Well, why did it come about first? Let's start with that. Because, like, what drove the need for this? There was nothing in place to kind of combat a problem, and that's kind of where this came from. That's about the general knowledge that I have of it.
This is really interesting because John Adams gets tied to the Alien Sedition Act.
He does.
Very closely. He wasn't a fan of it. Just to be honest with you. Now, he stood by the fact he signed it into law. Even in his later life, when people asked him if he wouldn't have signed it, he said he would. Because that's what he thought at the time was the best for the nation. So, the Alien Sedition Act is really broken up. It's three acts put together.
Right, right.
And it's three alien acts, and it's one sedition act. The Sedition Act was the controversial one at the time.
Is that the one that expired too, or is that the one that didn't expire?
Yeah, it got repealed, I believe, in 1803, or expired in 1803.
Yeah, I think it had a time limit on it.
Yeah. So why did it form? Well, they were passed 1798. We were in the middle of the quasi-war with the French. There was this mixture of like national security concerns, how free of freedom of the press. Like, that's one of the weird things. There was no freedom of press in the world beforehand. So like, you could have people with French leanings that were propagating misinformation. Misinformation has been around forever, literally forever. And what's your right as an individual to propagate misinformation? We don't know that today. We didn't know that when this first started. A lot of John Adams's career, or presidency, I should say, was experimenting with freedom, right?
Mm-hmm.
What is the limits of the freedom of the press? What are limits, right? You know, can you yell fire in a crowded movie theater, right? But we haven't adjudicated this.
Or at a violent protest.
Yeah, right. So,
sorry.
throwback to last episode. If anybody's not listening to that, go listen to me rant about the Boston Massacre as Kyle tries to keep me on base. So, what ends up happening is nobody really knows what the limits of this press is. Nobody knows, are you allowed to lie to newspaper? That was like kind of a concept that we didn't know yet. So, the first part of this was sedition. You know, sedition is basically like trying to cause divide, whether is that factual or non-factual information given?
Yeah, what's another word they use? Like inflammatory, not inflammatory, inciting, insightful, yes, language maybe?
Yeah, and it was by far the most controversial one. It criminalized three things. And these three things, okay, it had to be all three, had to be part of the statement. Mm-hmm. The statement had to be false. It had to be scandalous, but it also had to be malicious. So you could make something up that was scandalous, but if it was a joke, if it was like, oh, it's like, if you're like, yo, Thomas Jefferson is a huge fan of eating oranges, but he likes to eat them at tea time. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, that's scandalous and that's false, but it's not malicious. And so it outlawed that.
Why is that scandalous?
I don't know. I don't imagine Brits like oranges. Is that a bad thing? Can we phone a Brit?
I don't know. I think I have some friends that...
Yeah. Time is in England. We just call somebody up like that.
I know,
but,
right?
Yeah, but just something goofy like that.
Right. The intent is kind of it seems like, that's actually a really brilliant way to structure that, because we have things like satire. That's okay. You can say things that are not true and you're making a point. But looping all three of those together, that's brilliant, actually.
And of all the acts, it was the most enforced one,
mm-hmm.
at least at the time.
But it makes sense, because that's probably going to be the easiest way to increase your readership is by printing things that have all three of those deals, right? Yeah. Right. And if there's no regulation, you know, people aren't going to police themselves. They're going to do whatever makes the most money.
Yeah. Again, we have not changed as people.
No, not at all.
So... there was about 25-ish people prosecuted under this. Mm-hmm. The most famous one was Matthew Lyon. That was in 1798. He was a congressman from Vermont. And he was, because he read a bunch of letters talking trash about John Adams when he was president. He called him unbound thirst for ridiculous pomp and selfish avarice. He basically was just like making fun of the president. And that's where the Sedition Act became controversial, because they essentially just used it to anybody who was making fun of the federal government or the Federalists. Like,
yeah.
So he ended up, he got sentenced to 4 months in jail and fined $1,000 and won re-election to Congress from Vermont while still imprisoned.
Yeah, we haven't changed much at all.
We have not changed whatsoever. My personal favorite...
Sorry, quick question about the people who were prosecuted. You said 25 of them. Were they all of the same political leanings? Yeah. Was there any commonalities between them like that?
They were all very outspoken Democratic Republicans, most of them tied to newspapers or platformed in some way, yeah.
Now, is that because of the way just the Democrat or the political systems that kind of felt like the same way here, where like the major publications are going to be Democratic leaning? More likely to, yeah. So not much difference in...
No, I mean, like, we haven't changed at all. No, you're 100% right. Yeah, okay. That's what it was. Okay. It was just their leanings, and they were also ones more likely to criticize.
You're right, right. But so it's troubling to have the correlation that they're all kind of the same political backgrounds, where it looks like this law maybe was targeting a particular group, but there is a case to be made that that's just the way it kind of worked out.
Yeah, I wonder what would happen if it was, like, still... in effect, when Jefferson was elected, he would have used it to go after Federalists.
Right, right.
So, Kyle, one of my favorite things to do when I'm doing this research is I find stupid things. I find things that don't make a whole lot of, that I say don't survive thought, right?
Right.
And when I'm reading a paper that was published on this, and I'm reading it, and like I'm very sensitive about sources, like you know who I am, very very sensitive.
Yeah.
And I'm reading this, and it kept saying Benjamin Franklin. Benjamin Franklin was tried under the Sedition Act. Benjamin Franklin. And I'm sitting there going, but the Sedition Act was passed in 1797, 1798. Benjamin Franklin died in 1790.
Yeah, that doesn't make sense.
Benjamin Franklin Bach was the person. And I'm looking at that going, you are why there was a Sedition Act written, you person.
Yes.
That was false. That was scandalous. And that was malicious. So it's very he was Benjamin Franklin Bach was the editor of Aura, which is a newspaper that just, it was very funny because he got arrested for making fun of the Sedition Act. He was the grandson of Benjamin Franklin, but that's a huge difference between the founding father and like, I don't know, some dude with like with the same two thirds of the same name. Getting like a $200 fine.
Lower your taxes with this one simple trick.
Yeah.
So that's the Seditions Act.
Yeah. So the other three make up the alien portion, the Alien Sedition Act. You have the Aliens Friends Act, which basically said it gave the president the authority to deport any non-citizen he deemed dangerous to peace and safety of the United States, even if they had not committed a crime. And that was without due process. The other one's the Alien Enemies Act, which was the, that's when, if the U.S. is at war with you, you know, it authorizes the president to arrest, imprison, or deport any aliens who were nationals of countries the U.S. is at war with. Kind of an interesting one. That one, the Alien Enemies Act, was less controversial. All the Alien Acts were way less controversial than the Sedition Act. The Alien Friends Act was really controversial. It was really controversial because it's like you're just deporting people. Yeah. But the Alien Enemies Act was way more aggressive because, as you probably noticed, the Alien Friends Act doesn't allow the U.S. president to imprison somebody. The Alien Enemies Act does. And then there's one of them, which is the least controversial of any of all of them, is the Naturalization Act. It's a requirement that immigrants who want to become U.S. citizens have to, originally was only 5 years you had to be here, now you have to be 14 years. Mm-hmm. And you had to stay registered with the U.S. government during that time period. Kind of funny, the Federalists did, a lot of the Democratic Republicans argued the Federalists did this because they wanted to reduce, a lot of new arrivals to the United States were voting for the Democratic Republicans, and the Federalists wanted to curb that. But it was...
It almost sounds like we've always had kind of a love-hate relationship with immigration.
Yeah, for a country that's best resources, probably, the amount of incredibly talented people we attract.
Mm-hmm.
But what's funny is that again, not that wasn't that controversial. It's mostly like kind of shrug your shoulder. The Democratic Republicans fought it, but it wasn't as fought as the Sedition Act. The Sedition Act was messed up, you know, in a lot of cases. It basically outlawed, kind of was the first regulations on freedom of speech.
It sounds like they at least kind of tried to do it in a thoughtful way, but it also sounds like the implementation of it maybe wasn't quite as universal as it should have been.
Yeah, what's funny is, in private, we have a lot of letters of Adams very openly. This is about the Sedition Act, not the Aliens Act. But basically saying he didn't like it. He didn't think there should be any challenge to freedom of speech. He willfully admits it was probably his major downfall of his presidency. But again, sounds like
he still says he would have signed it, though.
Yeah, because I think he respected the congressional process. The first article in the Constitution is Congress. And then it did get repealed on March 3rd, 1801. I'm pretty sure it's like the day after Jefferson got sworn in.
Right.
Now, I do want to point out something that I don't think is talked about a lot. But after the Alien Sedition Acts were passed, states reacted differently. Particularly, and this was a lot of this was fermented by Thomas Jefferson. So very funny, you know, you were talking about the XYZ affair. Had Thomas Jefferson intervene? Well, this is the sitting vice president intervening against, because he was a Democratic Republican, intervening against his president. So there is something that popped up called the Virginia and Kentucky Resolution that were in response to the Alien Sedition Act. And this became this concept known as nullification, which is a state's ability to effectively nullify any law because... if it's not part of the Constitution, they don't have to follow it. They don't vote on a law, right?
That's how we have states that have legalized marijuana.
That's still legal at the federal level. You just can't bring it across states. Kyle, like, that's where your head went immediately.
I mean, you know, do what you know.
So one of the things I think is really funny is I remember learning about the concept of nullification when I was in school, and nobody ever tied it to the Alien Sedition Act. Even though that's directly where it came from.
Right, yeah.
And it was funny to think of, like, the sitting vice president being like, no, we're not doing this. it's like, what? Your president is going the opposite direction.
Yeah.
This was something that was heavily thrown against John Adams during his president, during the election of 1800. I would say it probably was the biggest thing he faced. It was probably the reason he lost. I mean, he didn't lose by that big of a margin at the time.
Well, that and I think the Barbary States tribute was kind of a big one, too.
Yeah.
Your Quincy presidents have kind of an interesting trajectory, it seems. All of them seem to have good idealistic principles, but they always end up, those principles end up costing them the re-election.
And they're happy to lose when that happens.
Yeah.
Fun fact, Massachusetts has four presidents from it. They all only served one term.
And we should be able to cover all of them, right?
Yeah. And they the average president from Massachusetts served less than one term.
Yeah. Thank Kennedy for that.
Yeah. Somebody got angry at me recently because I said the four presidents from Massachusetts, and they said, they said Kennedy, the Adams, and Coolidge. And I said, no, Coolidge is from Vermont. They go, who's the fourth? I said, George H.W. Bush. And they're like, he's from Texas. And I'm like, he's from Milton. He was born in Milton. Like, no, but he's originally from Texas. I was like, no, nope.
You can't be born somewhere and originally from somewhere else. It doesn't quite work that way.
He is from Massachusetts. And they're like, oh, yeah, but like, not really. I'm like, I don't know what you want from me. He was born. You can drive to where he was born.
I would have considered him a Texan. Is he buried in Quincy? Did he?
He's buried in Texas. But with that said, I love George H.W. Bush, so I will claim him as a Massachusettsian because he is born in Milton.
I think he should be in that church next to Abigail and John.
Just like his own like crypt.
Yeah.
God, I love H.W. Bush.
Stick him right in between them. Just put him right in the middle of the two.
In terms of smart presidents, I got to say Adams, John Quincy Adams, George H.W. Bush are all considered like top five smartest presidents.
H.W. Bush is the one that surprised me, but I remember reading about that too. Like he was like off the scales when it comes to intelligence.
Yeah, head of the CIA, vice president. Yeah. But like the coolest thing to me is that born to a wealthy family, and it was like, oh, what do you want to do during World War II? Do you want to like, you know, tap out because you're rich and I can have to go do something else? Naval aviator. It's like, what? You want to do the most dangerous job we have? Marine Corps flamethrower, naval aviator. That is the list of jobs you don't want. Oh, do you want to be one of the cool, you know, fighter planes? Torpedo bomber. Oh, you want to be the slowest thing we have?
The most dangerous job.
Yeah, at that time, that we don't even have good versions of.
Right.
Did you know he sponsored a child in, I think it was in the Philippines, during his whole, it was for the kid for like 10 years, like until he turned 18.
I remember hearing about that, actually, yeah.
Yeah, and my favorite thing is that they have the letters, the guy who got the letters for him. Release them, and he never tells him he's president. He goes by like Walker.
Oh, really?
In there, yeah. And he's like, "Oh, have you ever heard of the White House? Here, I sent you this thing I got at the White House when I went." And he's in office at the time. I'm like, God, I love that man. The man too good to be president. We had to raise taxes, and he was like, "I'll do what's best for the country." I'm going to get a lot of flame in this because I'm bringing up how much I love a modern president, but I do love.
I don't know if this is going to make it in this one.
No, it probably won't. That'd be a little.
It's a little it's a disservice to John Adams. Yeah. We need to wrap up with John, though, so I can get you off to your thing.
What do you do you want to wrap up on?
Is there anything more with the Alien Seditions Act that you want to say? Is there anything with them still going on today that maybe?
Yeah, do you want to reference, do you want to reference Trump using them?
I don't know that I...
Do you think I should talk about like there's some like the alien acts are still, you know, on the books today?
Yeah, let's talk about where they've been used since, and then let's kind of end it with that. I think.
I want to check something real quick before we end this. I did some research on this. Hold on, let me bring this up on my doc.
I might have done a little bit too on the.
Because I'm trying to see, I thought it was used for the, like you said, I thought it was used for the Japanese.
I thought it was used part of that, but not. It was not for the concentration camps, the detainment camps. It was another aspect of that, I think.
Yeah, I thought we deported. Yeah, presidential 2525.
1941, Franklin Roosevelt used the authority of the Revised Act to issue Proclamation 2525, yep, and 2526, and 2527.
Yeah, he used the Alien Enemies Act. Okay, yeah.
Yes, that's the one. That's the only one that didn't expire, right?
Yeah. Yeah, pretty much. For all intents and purposes, yeah.
Yeah, okay.
All right. So I'm going to do federal, I'll do the economic side real quick. I'll do like 30 seconds on the centralization of federal government. Affecting like the kind of stable that did stabilize the economy, the idea of this central this federal government is going to handle a lot of these external affairs, and that the states only need to worry about internal affairs, kind of countering the Kentucky shit, and then going to the Alien Act still being used today or still being on the books today.
Sounds good. Perfect.
All right, awesome.
Whenever you're ready.
All right, let me just bring this back up. Oh, I have so many freaking notes. All right. So one of the things that, you know, if we expand out a little bit from the Quasi Wars and from the Alien Sedition Acts, what we see is that the stabilization and kind of like the widespread acceptance that the federal government was going to handle external issues, and that the Constitution supported these congressional acts, and that though Virginia and Kentucky's resolutions, while good political theaters, didn't grant any authority for true nullification of congressional laws. What we start to see is a modern assemblage of how Congress and how laws in the United States pass. And as we know, stability is a key to economic prosperity. Adams kind of really introduced and brought that. But when we talk about the legacy of some of these actions, especially the Alien and Sedition Act, is the Alien Enemies Act is still, for all intents and purposes, still a thing. Yeah. And this is actually something that Kyle clued me into during this. And this is unfair. See, this is embarrassing because Kyle comes into this, you know, naked. I'm the one who gets to do all the research. Not my job is supposed to be to shock and horrify Kyle. But Kyle, do you want to? I would like to yield the floor to Kyle.
Oh, I was just, I was kind of surprised to see that the Alien Enemies Act, still in existence, as you mentioned, but it was also used in response to the bombing of Pearl Harbor. Franklin Roosevelt used authority of the revised Alien Enemies Act to issue proclamations, 2525, 2526, and 2527, which declared Japanese, German, Italians as enemies and gave the authority to apprehend, restrain, secure, and remove non-citizens from those countries. It also was used in another time, too, I believe. I thought it was used during World War I, maybe, but I could be wrong on that. I'm trying to look and see.
Either way, it's crazy to think that a law passed.
Yeah, 1941, a law that was written in 1978 was used to... and not necessarily, I mean, the way this thing has been enforced in the years has not been without controversy, I guess is the easiest way to say that. this was not the camps that everyone thinks of, the Japanese internment camps. This is something different than that. Yes. There's another justification used for that. But yeah, the fact that they're still using this thing, you know, not that long ago, like less than, 70 years ago, is kind of shocking. And in talks of being used today, which I'm not going to get into in this program, that's but a little too close to today's politics to touch.
Yeah, but it is fascinating. Like, we think about these, you know, people living 200-plus years ago, but in reality, the decisions made by the Founding Fathers, by John Adams, are still alive and around today.
Fucking
the
wild.
U.S. Navy... is still floating around being the baddest force in the world to mess with. We still have Haxity pushed in. We still have, you know, policy of midnight appointments, which we'll get into next episode. Legacy still exists today.
I cannot wait to talk about those midnight appointments. And man, part of the legacy too, I think we really have to give him credit here, is that he stepped in. Like, he didn't have the same pull that Washington had, right?
No, not even close. He nominated. He wanted to convince people to go with Washington.
Right. So for him to come in and follow in those footsteps and hold the shit together, I think is just way more impressive than people probably give him credit for.
Yeah. No, he was a son of a humble farmer and shoemaker and became the most influential constitutionalist to ever live, for the most powerful government to ever, the most powerful nation to ever exist, and founded the most powerful branch of any military to ever exist. And, you know, he was just some humble farmer who really believed in something when he believed in it, who famously told his wife when he retired and went back to Peacefield that he was happy to hold Congress with all his animals because they actually listened to him.
It sounds about right. Man, just guy, I mean... His presidency was proof that this experiment was going to work, right? Because Washington holding it together, that's no surprise, I think, to anybody.
Yeah.
But John Adams coming in after the fact, holding it together and improving on it, that, I think, is the legacy that maybe gets glossed over.
Yeah. You know, it's nice to see years later this sometimes could be seen as forgotten, certainly truthful to comic and tankerous president, is
let me look at his portrait.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not exactly warm and inviting.
Yeah, but is getting the, which is funny because he was probably like the most faithful of all the presidents,
right?
Of, to his wife, absolutely adored Abigail.
Yeah,
it's cool to see him getting his just rewards. It may have taken 200 plus years, but he's seen for what he is, a man of incredible moral fiber, a man who categorically rejected slavery, a man who remembered the ladies, as Abigail Adams wrote him, somebody who looked at
kind of. They didn't vote and he was done. Let's say that.
I'm going to go ahead and say that was not up to John Adams on that
No,
side
probably
of it.
Not.
No, but a man who viewed his wife as an equal.
Yes.
Who, you know, paid for the education of, like, that's the craziest thing. We'll talk more about it. But, like, the Adamses, they had a gentleman who worked for them who's a freed black man at the time, who they paid for his education. And they would publicly argue with people who'd be like, well, why are you paying for his education? Because he wants to learn. Mm-hmm. He was the man who wrote a constitution that outlawed slavery, which is crazy. Like, at that time, is perplexing to anybody. I mean, at the time, there was 20,000 slaves living in New York City. We don't think of New York City as a slave state.
Right.
But just when he believed that he had the moral high ground, he truly believed it. And it's funny, as we sit and think about this 200 years later, you hear these shots fired at the Founding Fathers. I remember I saw a picture on Twitter one time, and it had, it was tweeted by somebody with a pretty big following, I won't use their name, and it was a picture of all the Founding Fathers, and the guy had put a red dot on every single Founding Father and said everybody with a red dot on them was a slave owner, and they wrote the Second Amendment. And I hardly ever tweeted, so my old Twitter account, so it's probably still in the Wayback Machine, I responded, I said, the guy who you left a red dot over, John Adams, is the guy who wrote Article 15 of the Massachusetts Constitution, and I linked to it, and it's the wording that became the Second Amendment. And I go, the guy the argument you're making is that's the guy who proves your argument wrong. And he deleted the tweet, and it already had like 1.1 billion like likes. And I was very happy.
Satisfying,
with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, don't apologize and correct the facts.
Right. Just delete it.
Yeah.
Where's that sedition act when you need it?
Yeah. No. Exactly. Right. That was malicious. That was false.
Yes.
What a good way to end the episode, Kyle. He would have got in trouble for that.
All right. Well, that's going to wrap it up for part two, I think. Next week, we'll be looking at other key people events that shaped Adams's legacy. But in the meantime, let us know your thoughts on the second president's policies. Where does he rank on your all-time list of greats? Email us at chinashopproductions@gmail.com. Visit the website, thebuckstartsherepodcast.com, to stay up to date. And we will see you all next week.